This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. At the State House, the Times reports that the Indiana House voted 93-0 today to send a bill onto the Senate that, if passed by the Indiana Senate, would call for a legislative study committee to identify how the state can eliminate the Northwest Indiana emissions testing mandate and still remain under the federal pollution limits. The study committee, if the bill's passed, would then make recommendations to lawmakers by November 1st. It's a bill sponsored by Representative Charlie Brown of Gary, who explained the 37-year-old testing requirement to his colleagues, which he says costs the state more than $5 million a year and is no longer needed because he says region motorists are not the primary source of emissions. Brown says that emissions from vehicles traveling through the region and pollution from Chicago is heavier than any pollution that's made by the vehicles that are registered in Lake and Porter counties. Indiana's first female sheriff is the subject of a play to be performed next weekend. It's a play that was written decades ago but is just now coming to the stage, even if it is one that was set up in the Mackey Ballroom at the historic old courthouse in downtown Crown Point. I talked with the man who made the play, wrote the play, is directing it, Marion Kellum, and first asked him to explain the importance of how Lillian Holly plays in Lake County history.
I came to Crown Point in 1959, and I'm out walking around town as a young man, a teacher at the high school, and I read about Dillinger and the jail, and which was still being used as a jail, and the sheriff's house was there and so forth, and I got really interested in it. And then I realized right away that people in town didn't want to talk about it. They were very leery of saying anything about the escape because of the embarrassment that it had caused at the time. But it struck me that, and the more I learned about Lillian Holly, I mean, what an admirable character. And here she is, a woman, when women had very few opportunities to have much of a control over anything. She's suddenly the sheriff of a pretty lively county with lots going on in it. And I had daughters, and I thought they need, and I had girls in class. So I was teaching a drama class, and I said, I was assigning them, pick up somebody, a celebrity or a historical figure or a politician, and just do a little scene, create a little scene, be that person for a few minutes. And the girls were having trouble coming up with it. And I said, well, what about Lillian Holly? And there was this silence in class. They didn't know her name. And I thought, this is not right. So I got the idea, maybe I should just write a little play, and we would do that at the high school. So I talked to several people, and I said, well, Lillian's not going to like that. So I wrote her a letter, and I explained everything that I just said. And my friends, George Pyle, a lot of other people that knew her personally, said, she's not going to talk to you. You've got to know that. She called me on the phone about 3 weeks later. I'd forgotten all about it. And she talked at length. She was very kind and explained, you know, about the grand jury and everything, you know, what the guards actually saw. Did they see a real gun? Did they see a wooden gun? And I was thrilled. I was thunderstruck. And she was so kind to me. But the last thing she said was, I don't want you to write the play.
Why did she want you not to write the play?
Their feeling after the escape, the town really came around her like a shield. She did not want to discuss it anymore. She had, for months after, in fact, extending to years. I came in 59, so that's 20 years after the escape, at least. There were authors and movie people, and so still calling her and trying to get her to speak, to give them some kind of permission to have the inside story about, and it was all about Dillinger. Well, the town got really sick and tired of their words, glorifying Dillinger, and, you know, the whole nation, the world, looked at Crown Point and our woman sheriff. We were an embarrassment. They criticized her as if she had somehow failed. She had done something wrong that caused this to happen. So nobody wanted to talk about it, including her.
Now, what does it turn out in what you had in your, not only your conversations with Lillian, but what you may have done in research as well, too, as to why these things happen? Why did it seem that everybody in Crown Point at the time was embarrassed about this? Was there any fault that could be laid upon the sheriff's department at the time?
I personally don't think so. I've done a lot of research. I've read a number of books. A man who really was closely allied, knew Louis Paquette, who was Dillinger's lawyer. And he took extensive notes when Dillinger would meet with Louis, all the whole inside story of that. Assuming that this document, this manuscript that just turned up not too long ago, it seems very real to me. And there was really a conspiracy of the Dillinger gang made connections with pretty crooked police officers and politicians in East Chicago, and they set the whole thing up. They really had it all very carefully planned. Now, Louis Paquette absolutely forbade any of them to smuggle a real gun into the place. But he found out about a case in Wisconsin where a convict there had whittled a gun and just, convinced everybody that it was a gun by, he'd stick it in somebody's back. You don't know, if you don't know it's a gun, you don't want to take the chance of getting the guy angry. So the guy was able to walk right out of prison. So he said that will work, And so they had a gun made and took it in there. There's real evidence that a jail guard named Blunk who was the first one taken. Dillinger got him first. Now, Blunk, of course, insists that he assumed there was a gun, and he surrendered his keys and his weapon to Dillinger because he didn't want to get shot. But there's some real suspicious idea. He definitely knew the people that we suspect in East Chicago. Well, for instance, Zarkovich. I don't know if you know, but Zarkovich is the police detective East Chicago who contacted the FBI later after the escape, and he was starting to get nervous about his connection being connected, and he got them connected with the lady in red, the mm-hmm. woman who, so they could figure out where Dillinger was going to be at a particular place and time, and of course in front of the Biograph Theater. So Zarkovich and Blunt knew each other well, worked together in a lot of things, and that's the theory that I'm going with. There are a lot of theories out there. Mine is not and it isn't mine. It's from this particular book.
We're talking with Marion Kellum, a resident of Crown Point, who has talked to the sheriff named Lillian, which is hence the name of the play that this being put on at the old historic courthouse in downtown Crown Point. And we in turn found out here at least a little background as to the jailbreak at the Lake County Jail when it was downtown in Crown Point at the time. We know now it's the impetus in getting together the ideas and the information to create the play. And fast forward to 2017. Obviously, at the time you say that Lillian didn't want the play to be written, and obviously you probably had to wait until her passing to be able to bring it to light now, didn't you?
And wonderfully, as she is an outstanding person in so many ways. She died at 103.
So, which is why it's taken so long from the 1950s to be able to finally put this on.
That's right. And she had twin daughters, as you may well know. And the daughters, the one daughter was in the Coast Guard during the Second World War and got she retired from that as a lieutenant commander, I think she was. She rose in rank. A woman in the Coast Guard, very unusual. So it was a family of outstanding women. When she came back to Crown Point, she continued to live with her mother all that time, and was very much. They were very close, and they worked together well. As did the twin sister, married and lived in Pennsylvania, but was in and out. The daughter Janet died I'm saying 17 days, I think it was, within a week and a half after Lillian died. Mm-hmm. I think that's, you know, that's really interesting.
Which is not unusual for family members who are so close like that. You hear about that all the time husbands and wives that have been married for 50, 60, 70 years longer. And that's, they just,
they're each other's support.
That's
system,
right. You know, they've lived together so long, they can't hardly think of themselves as not being a couple, I suppose.
I think that's
When the opportunity finally presented itself now to be able to put the play on, let's talk about some of the obstacles that you run into, and when you put on a small production in a small place like the courtroom at the historic courthouse in Crown Point.
Oh, that's right. It's not a theater, and it hasn't doesn't have grid work in the ceiling to hang lights, and it doesn't have we have to create a sound system. We have to set a stage in the middle of a ballroom that's used almost every weekend for wedding receptions. And it's a beautiful room. It's hardwood floors and beautiful brass chandeliers, which, by the way, were contributed by Lillian Holley. She was on the ground floor of helping to restore the courthouse when we got it from the Lake County politicians, and they had let it run down. I mean, they knew they were moving out. They didn't want to put taxpayer money into preserving something that they weren't going to use anymore. And so when we started restoring it, we knew we had to make it some way useful, mm-hmm. so that we could keep bringing in money to keep it under in repairs. And so she saw this room that we were going to make in a ballroom, and she bought those brass chandeliers. And also, you know, the four clocks on the clock tower. Mm-hmm. You can see them from I-65. You can see, you know, they're the center of that town. They're the heart of the town. Well, for years they hadn't worked. It takes money to repair them, and the politicians didn't do that. She found a company that works on such huge clocks and huge machinery and gears. I've been up there. It's an amazing mechanism. She got that company there, and not only that, but she'd go up and supervise them too.
Well, tell us about the play, Lillian, since we have an idea of what the play is about here, talking about Lake County Sheriff Lillian Holley, and your conversations and the writing of the play and the like. Tell us about how I won't say difficult, but certainly challenging, to say the least, in being able to cast such a play like this.
It is difficult to cast it. This is a typical example. Lillian had twin daughters, and the focus of the play is not on Dillinger. Of course, the escape figured in Lillian's life very much, but I'm showing the family life, their concern about their daughters, the relationship between she and Roy, her husband, and his nephew, Carol. And so I knew that during the years of the escape, I start the play when he is unexpectedly elected sheriff. He was a dentist, a very successful, popular dentist in Gary and Hammond, and the Democratic Party said, you know, we need to fill a slot. They're not going to win, but would you please run for sheriff? So he did. And surprise, surprise, he won and served his first term very, very well. Well, the daughters, by the time of the escape, were 18. So I naturally wanted, if I'm starting in about 28 or so when he was getting elected, that's when I start the play, they would have been, you know, with a few years younger than that. Not younger than 12, certainly. So I'm looking for girls like that age. Well, the high school right now is doing a wonderful, wonderful production, by the way, of Kiss Me, Kate. Mm-hmm. And they're wonderful actresses out there in Crown Point. They're, you know, any actress who wants, they want to be in that musical, of course. I could not find two teenage girls to do. But I found two delightful. Oh, they're the sweetest, cutest little buttons, but they're only like 10, mm-hmm. and they're great little actresses. They really, I've never worked with children that young before, but
they're just not 12 years old. Just have to work around that.
And if members of the family come, by the way, just recently, one of Lillian's granddaughters, I think the only one, in fact, called me from California and said, what about this play? I hope you're going to be, you know, do honor to her and so forth. And I said, don't worry, don't get everybody's name spelled right. Well, she wouldn't be happy to find out that I portrayed her mother in the play, Lillian's daughter, as 10 years old when, in fact, she was 19. But we have to do what we have to do to get a production on the ground.
So we are all set for the play. Now, tell us a little bit about when it's going to be on here and some of the particulars, too, what people need to know to be able to get their tickets to be able to attend this event at the in the ballroom at the courthouse.
Well, thank you very much for asking that question. That's why I'm here. You can go online and get tickets at Brown Paper Tickets. It's www.browntapepapertickets.com. That's just fine. Or you can call the Historic Lake County Courthouse Foundation, and that number is 663-0660. The tickets are $25 for adults, and we've got a special $15 ticket for students. We haven't done that in the past, but we feel that this play, we're hoping that younger people will get to see it and get information about it.
Are you hoping that when Lillian comes before everybody there in the ballroom of the historic old courthouse in Crown Point, maybe it won't necessarily create a resurgence of interest in Lillian Holly, but at least we'll bring some interest back in this historical time, despite the fact that it was an embarrassment to the people of Crown Point?
That's exactly what I want to do. I think we should honor our figures in history, and Lillian Holly she's a wonderful person. She is a great people that I would like for our young people to know about, and we should respect that history, and we should be truthful, but know that she stood up very bravely in a very difficult situation. And her words, I quote her again and again in the play, stand by themselves.
Lillian will be performed in the Mackey Ballroom of the Historic Old Courthouse in Crown Point on Friday, March 3rd, Saturday, March 4th, and Sunday, March 5th. And you can go to brownpapertickets.com to get your tickets online, or you can find out more by calling 663-0660. The 2017 Kids Count Indiana Data Book, data that's been compiled from hundreds of national and statewide sources to be able to give us an idea of what it is like to be a child in the Hoosier State. And the latest figures show that Hoosier children are surviving, not thriving. In fact, that's the headline that's on the news release. It's out by the Indiana Youth Institute today. And with us to talk about it, we have the president and CEO of the IYI, Tammy Silverman, with us. Tammy, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
You bet. My pleasure.
Some good news and some bad news, and even look at some of the figures as well for Lake and for Porter counties here. But taking a look first at the Hoosier State, give us an idea of how we see that, how successful things have been in programs that affect Hoosier children seem to be, I guess, this at least going from 2016 into this year.
Well, it's kind of a mixed bag, Chris. You know, just like you said, there are some areas where we are seeing some improvements, which is great. As far as cyberbullying, teen pregnancy, all of those numbers, the number of kids that are graduating from high school, all of those things have gone in the right direction, so that's positive. And at the same time, we have some real concerns that we need to pay attention to, particularly in areas such as child abuse and neglect, the number of kids that are living in poverty, teen suicide, and teen dating violence. Some of those areas, you know, our state isn't faring as well, and those are things that we can step up and take some action to help improve for our kids.
Let's take a moment first, take a look at the numbers that are out on child abuse and neglect, and tell us how the state ranked here, since going back as far back as 2011.
Well, we know that the number of calls that are coming in continues to increase, and so the state rates, actually, as far as our number of kids who have been abused or neglected, have risen steadily since 2011. And so you can take a look at that. Again, part of our data book is to look at it from the statewide perspective, but then you can also boil it down to your individual county. So that, for example, we know that in 2015, 17 out of every 1,000 Hoosier kids were abused or neglected. You know, when you look at Lake County, that number was a little bit lower. It was at 15 per 1,000, and Porter County was even lower than that. So both Lake and Porter County are faring better than the state as far as their number of kids who were abused or neglected. But overall, of course, we always want those numbers to be as low as possible because, again, we're talking about our kids who are in harm's way.
We're also looking, too, at figures showing how the Hoosier children deal with it's not, of course, not up to them. It's up to their parents, and their parents are having financial problems. It's not going to fare well for the youngsters. Tell us how the child poverty rates have turned out here based on the data.
Well, we know that overall for our state, unemployment is down, the median income is increasing for the state, and yet we know that one in five Hoosier kids still live in poverty. That's a little bit down but from the last year, from the prior year, but it's still slightly higher than the national average. And so if you look at that, about 20%, Lake County is actually 26%. So 26% of the kids in Lake County are living in poverty, and it's 14.8% for Porter County. So again, we want to take a look at what does that mean. Obviously, that means that more of those kids are likely to be homeless or to live in unsafe housing. They maybe not have enough food. There's not adequate child care. And all of those things compound into negative impacts for the kids themselves.
I understand, too, that at least from the statewide figures, that it turns out that it's families with only one parent that have the most problems these days.
Absolutely. And so, again, when you think about it, even breaking it down to economically, single mothers struggle the most. And so 50% of kids in single mother families live in poverty. And obviously, part of that has to do with if there's not parental leave or child care available, then that cuts down on their ability to earn a living that can help those kids as well. So, yes, most definitely we know that when it's a single parent and specifically when it's a single parent mother household, the economic challenges are real both for that family and that child.
We're talking with Tammy Silverman, who's president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, taking a look at the data that's in the latest Kids Count data book for the state of Indiana and breaking some of those figures down for here in Lake and in Porter counties. I understand that a survey from high school students shows that many of them are apparently involved in some rather risky, potentially dangerous relationships. Tell us whether the teen dating violence fits into the picture in the data.
Well, teen dating violence, we know, unfortunately, both physical violence and sexual violence, again, Indiana ranks higher than the national average. So about 10% of Hoosier high schoolers who are dating report being physically hurt on purpose by a dating partner. Of those same kids that are dating, over 10% have been forced to have some sort of sexual activity that they did not consent to, which is 10% versus 6.7% nationally. So again, this is something where we need to step up as adults and help educate kids on what does a respectful, healthy dating relationship look like. You know, there's going to be some ups and downs with teen dating, but being awkward and having things not go how you want is very, very different than it being unsafe. And really those levels of abuse are something that we can all actively work to combat.
And sad to say, too, that Hoosier teens are still very prone to suicide, and there's some problems there. What Tammy did, the figures for the IYI show, at least from 2016.
Absolutely. What we know is that suicide is the second leading cause of death for 15 to 24-year-olds in Indiana, and that's been consistent for the past couple of years. And so, you know, they break that down into four different categories, the number of teens that have thought about suicide, those that have made a plan, those that have actually attempted, and those that have attempted and needed medical attention. And in all four of those categories, Indiana ranks higher than the national average. So this is something we need to pay close attention to because our kids are really struggling, particularly with depression. And there's a variety of factors that feed into that, but we're seeing the wake-up call in the number of kids who are thinking about or attempting suicide.
I understand there are a couple good points that have come out of the data. One of them involves the number of homeless students here in Indiana, as well as school bullying problems, because we still have that as a problem in our schools across Indiana. But I guess the figures show some improvement. Tell us about those, please.
There is improvement in both of those numbers. Yeah. And so that's that's great news. The other one that I would say, besides, you're right, homelessness has also gone down for the first time in several years, actually. Bullying occurring at school has gone down. Cyberbullying, we see some improvement in that. We also know, and this is one of those key factors, that our teens are telling us that their parents are involved in their lives. So they tell us that if they were to attempt to skip school or if they were to use drugs or alcohol, their parents would find out and would take action. They also said that, you know, their parents are around and have clear rules. And we know those components are really safety factors, that kids that believe that their parents are involved, engaged, and that have clear rules really increases the well-being of those kids. So there is some good news.
And I understand, too, that as far as students who go on from high school to go into college, they work hard not only to keep up their grades and to be able to pay for the bills as well, too, help share the costs of going to college. And I guess we find now that there are more full-time college students that are finishing up on time, that they don't have to spend 4 years or 5 years or 6 years, rather, getting out of a four-year college.
Absolutely. A greater percentage of our kids are our full-time college students are earning their degrees on time compared to previous years. And I know that's been something we've all talked about, you know, this six-year student. We're seeing more that are actually graduating in 4 years. We also know that, you know, as far as apprenticeships, Indiana has really been stepping up the number of apprenticeships that are out there and available so that kids, like you said, can succeed beyond high school. So we know that, you know, a greater number of our kids are engaging in the workforce and that we're providing those options for them to succeed.
Now, Tammy, who gets to take advantage of the data that is in the Kids Count book from the IYI? Does that information get shared with the state sources or with local sources as well to be able to help craft improvement to programs that need to be improved?
Well, you're absolutely right, Chris. We do provide that actively to those policymakers and those community leaders. But then in reality, it's available to anyone on our website, so anybody that's interested. So if you're an engaged, active parent or a grandparent or a concerned neighbor or a teacher or whatever that might be, you can go right on our website at iyi.org. You can look at the overall numbers for the state, and then you can also drill down and take a look at how your county compares to our state averages. Yes, we do use it for many conversations going forward on how to help kids, but it's accessible to everyone.
Information that's come out today about the data from the Kids Count book, but what other information comes out from the IYI here on a regular basis that people can use as well, not only from this data in the Kids Count book, but other data that comes out to help judge and make good decisions on programs?
Well, we pick up on a few of these issues and really go deep. Like we were talking about teen dating violence, we mm-hmm. have what we call an issue brief that's available that really goes into some of those root causes and talks about also not only what are the causes of that particular issue, but what you can do to help. And so there are a variety of those topics available that you can pull down more information. So we go a little deeper, as well as having some webinars and trainings and all of that. So again, it's not just isolated to data and numbers, but we go beyond that to say, what are the solutions that are available and how can we all step up and take action?
So it's probably a good idea to go online to iyi.org, take a look at what's there, bookmark the page so you can go and check back again, especially if you find out there might be some webinars or some other programs here in Northwest Indiana to check out that will be of benefit to you. Tammy Silverman is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. Tammy, thank you for joining us to tell us the latest on the 2016, going into 2017, Kids Count book, the data book, and we hope to hear more back from you soon.
Thanks so much. A pleasure.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Indiana Supreme Court's Commission on Race and Gender Fairness is beginning to hold a series of community forums across the Hoosier State. The first of the series is this evening. It'll be at 6 o'clock our time. It'll be over at the Anderson Conference Room, room 105, on the IU Northwest campus in Gary. And to talk more about not only these community forums, but the commission itself, we have Myra Selby, who's with the Indiana Commission on Race and Gender Fairness. Myra, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me.
Take a moment or two and tell us more about what the Commission on Race and Gender Fairness is, how the Indiana Supreme Court created this organization, and the idea of creating the series of community forums around the state, including Gary, that in turn will look for some input from the public.
Certainly. Well, the Indiana Supreme Court created this commission now almost 2 decades ago, and its work is focused on examining questions of race and gender fairness in the judicial system and in the legal system. And the commission is a group of individuals appointed by the Chief Justice to the commission, and we examine these questions over periods of time by going out to the public in these forums and asking the public to come in and talk to us about their experiences in the judicial system and in the legal system more broadly. And then we examine all of that input and from it make recommendations to the Supreme Court for changes, improvements, or focus on opportunities.
Now, I'm sure that the commission, although it's been around for a while, as you say, it was created in 1999 to take a look at these issues involving race and gender fairness. But certainly with the addition of members of the Indiana Supreme Court who are women, and most notably, of course, now Chief Justice Loretta Rush, has this kind of put a different light, or certainly a more emphasized light on the idea of being more fair, not only by gender, but racial equality as well?
I believe that the court has long been focused on the importance of fairness and how it really propels and relates to the work of our courts. I think that quite rightly, when the commission was formed, I think it was at a time when state court systems all over the country were taking up concerns about some of the aspects of our courts and our court system that might have some issues of fairness. And again, whether that be in fact, in individual and specific circumstances, or in perception. And particularly our public forums, which were kicking off with the first one being in Gary this evening, perception is very important, and it as they say, it may become reality, and we don't want, as a commission, to not be mindful of what people's experiences are, as well as their perceptions of fairness.
Now, have there been any other similar community forums have been held in the past since the commission's been around for a number of years that have gotten them information that has been used, or at least certainly documented up to this point? And these are the latest in the series of community forums coming up.
That's correct. We will have four forums around the state between now and about the third week in March. Mm-hmm. And to answer your question, this is not the first time that the commission has been out. And in fact, in some of these cities, including Gary, this will be our third time back to the city of Gary with public forums.
Oh.
And in some of the other cities, we've been there before, either once or twice. So this is something that the commission has done before, and we feel a very deep commitment to the public to come back and talk with them again and let them know what the court has done and what improvements have been made and changes, as well as to hear from them more about, well, how are you experiencing the courts and the judicial and legal system now.
Well, Myra, it sounds like that the commission members are looking forward to making the trek back up I-65 to come back up into Gary to the IU Northwest campus, where they're going to have this evening's first in the series of community forums to talk about the issue and find out what new they can learn that they, and in turn add, as you say, expand the dialogue and find out more that the Indiana Supreme Court needs to do about this. We know that the visitation there on campus is free. They've asked for some registration ahead of time. I suppose there's probably some time left, but can folks have an opportunity to come by this evening at 6 o'clock and just come in and listen in and participate?
Absolutely. Please just come. Registration is only for purposes of bookkeeping, and please come.
Well, I'm sure they'll probably take count at the door when people come in anyway. So we should mention again, the forum is going to be this evening, 6 o'clock local time. It'll be in the Anderson Conference Room, which is room 105 there in the IU Northwest. I think it's in the Savannah Center. And by the way, too, if you need to park on campus, lot number 2 is going to withhold ticketing people from 5:30 until 8:30 today. So that this way, if you come to the event and you don't happen to have a parking pass for lot number 2, you're not going to be ticketed by the IU Northwest police. They'll give you a special dispensation for this evening's community forum. It's being held by the Indiana Supreme Court's Commission on Race and Gender Fairness, one of the first now in the series of forums. And as you've heard Myra Selby say, it's be the third time that they've come back into Gary. Myra, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today about this. We hope you get a good attendance tonight, and for that matter, at all of the community forums that are going to be held across the state.
Thank you so much for having me.
A lead-contaminated public housing complex in East Chicago could soon become a lead-contaminated vacant lot. And if local and federal officials can't resolve a key dispute, it may stay that way for a long time. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek reports that the city government and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency are at odds over redevelopment plans for the neighborhood.
Architect Taggy Ershami has worked on development projects in Northwest Indiana for decades. His office in a residential part of Merrillville is strewn with blueprints and mock-ups of new uses for post-industrial neighborhoods, including West Calumet Housing Complex in East Chicago.
Let me see. Yeah, this was final CP.
His firm drew up a plan several years ago to renovate the development's cramped, outdated houses. That was around the same time the EPA and city were debating how best to get lead and arsenic out of the neighborhood's soil. It's just one part of the EPA's Superfund site in East Chicago, slated for industrial waste cleanup since 2009. Back then, the city and EPA weren't planning to tear down the housing complex. But that changed last summer, when the city learned the contamination was far worse than expected. They ordered the complex demolished, and Ershami says his redevelopment plan was scrapped.
It was a disappointment when we heard about all of the lead issues. We really felt that that area offers opportunity for development or redevelopment.
East Chicago Mayor Anthony Copeland always thought so, too. He's advocated since 2012 for a cleanup method that would help enable redevelopment in West Calumet. In a transcript of a public meeting that year with the EPA, Copeland said his greatest fear, once the EPA was gone and the city began redevelopment, was, quote, our dollars would not be vast enough to even put a dent in the problem, and then we would eventually have a wasteland. Despite this and residents' more immediate fears about their health, the EPA settled on a cleanup method that was less comprehensive and less expensive than many wanted. The agency planned to remove just the top 2 feet of soil, where most contamination lay, and put barriers in place to seal off anything deeper, all still without tearing down any homes. The city's move to demolish upended the EPA's plans. An agency spokesperson says in an email that, quote, future use of the property guides the cleanup. She says the EPA has asked the city to provide its plans for the future of West Calumet. But Mayor Copeland has not provided a plan. The EPA's 2014 consent decree with the companies responsible for the contamination commits them to cleaning up residential parts of the Superfund to a residential safety standard. With that decree still in place, Copeland says the EPA has to keep its promise, demolition or not.
Any development there that will require residents or visitors coming into our city to interact in that area means that you would have to have a level of safety that says residential standards, just like the decree said.
Ultimately, the EPA can't stop the city from tearing the complex down. The Department of Housing and Urban Development makes that approval, and Regional Administrator Jim Cunningham says they're in the final stages of doing so. He says the land will still be part of the public housing system, even when it's vacant. But since it's part of an EPA Superfund now,
I think the likelihood of HUD funding housing back on that site is highly unlikely.
Cunningham expects the city will eventually ask HUD to remove West Calumet's public housing designation altogether. For its part, he says HUD doesn't need specifics about cleanup and redevelopment plans until then. Now, HUD funding isn't the only way the city could keep West Calumet residential, but Taggy Ershami, the architect, isn't optimistic it'll be feasible to build homes on the site in the future, especially if the EPA sticks with its original topsoil-focused cleanup method.
I don't believe it is going to be used as a residential area unless EPA spends substantial amount of money to fully clean it up.
He thinks it might be better suited for an industrial use, like it had before the housing complex was ever built. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Every year, the city of Gary and its mayor takes time to review the work that's been done and to plan for the future. Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore takes a look at some of the highlights of Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson's latest State of the City address.
In her 2017 State of the State address, Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson says the biggest issue facing her administration is jobs for Gary residents.
Not a week passes, in fact, not a day passes, that someone doesn't write or stop me on the street about needing a job. Recently, a young man who is working to build a life for himself and his family penned these words. I don't feel like I'm fulfilling my responsibility as a husband and a father. I need a job.
Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson says in 5 years, they have created 2,500 jobs, but that's not enough. To combat the problem, she has started small business incubator programs and created job training through the Northwest Indiana Regional Training Center.
For us to stabilize our community, to fill some of these abandoned houses, attract retailers, residents must have jobs to support themselves and their families.
The mayor also says as people make judgments about how Gary is doing, they need to remember the financial climate that Gary has inherited, a dwindling tax base of commercial and residential properties. To deal with that issue, she called for a new county tax, cut city jobs, and consolidated services.
We welcome accountability. In fact, Ron and I talk about it all the time. We just want to make sure that you measure us by the right standards. You can't look at what the city did 10 or 15 years ago and ask, why don't we do it anymore? We don't have the revenue we had then. When there is a hurricane or a tornado or some other disaster, people rush to the aid of that community, and they should. We have survived the decline of the steel industry, the shift of taxes from industry to residents, the implementation of constitutional tax caps, the impact of the subprime mortgage debacle, the disorderly departure of residents who abandoned entire households of goods in search of greener pastures to support their families, and people who have been selective about their inheritance. Now, what do I mean about that? Well, they take the money, but they leave the property. It is not just a storm. It is a financial tsunami. But because it's not a natural disaster, and because the impact is much more gradual, help has been slower to come.
The city has already torn down 1,500 buildings. The mayor has tackled this problem with a public-private development project.
MIACO is a public-private partnership with a group who understands our development challenges and are willing to raise and spend the dollars and invest in the city's effort to make property ripe for development. Now, armchair quarterbacks talk about all the land in Gary, but most of that land requires quiet title actions, remediation, and the demolition of structures. That requires money that the city simply does not have. MIACO will give us the dollars to clear property and co-develop it. The city retains possession of the property until a developer is engaged. Once the development occurs, the city and MIACO will share in the profit, with them getting 60% because they brought the money to the table, and the city getting 40%. Now that sounds like a pretty good deal to me.
Despite the issues she's facing, she's optimistic about the future and says things are changing for the better.
After hearing this forecast, you are probably wondering, that girl's smiling all the time. What does she have to smile about? I smile because I have learned to count progress one step at a time. As a trial lawyer, it used to be guilty or not guilty. You win or you lose. But now I know that victory comes in paved streets when streets had not been paved in 10 years. It comes in our ability to start a 50-50 sidewalk program when we had not done sidewalks in 20 years.
In Gary, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
On this Monday, it's time for Eye on the Arts with host John Kane of South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Phil Potempa, the Marketing Director for Theater at the Center at the Center for Visual and Performing Arts in Munster. Hey, Phil, how are you?
I'm very good. Hello, John.
Well, you're about to kick off your first show of the season.
That's right. And not only kick it off, but instead of the usual 5 weeks, we're doing 6 weeks of Frank Sinatra, because he's a man that needs at least 6 weeks to complete all of the things that are the accomplishments of his life showcased on stage. In My Way, the musical tribute to Frank Sinatra and his music. And it's 53 of his greatest hits woven into a timeline of his life, achievements, accomplishments, and even some of those notorious moments.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were a lot of those, weren't
yes,
there?
It was
earlier. So 53 songs. How do you pack 53 songs into one show?
That's the question that so many people wonder. And what they've done is they've done them in sets. So you may not get the full song,
sure,
but you get enough that you're thinking, that's right, that's a Sinatra song. Yep, I remember that one. And every one of those hits is there, and they're done in these clever segments that also have themes. So it can be the love theme. It can be his world destinations, where you've got New York. You've got Chicago as the different tunes. So they really, really blend nicely.
And does this at the same time tell the story of his life?
It does. So we have four performers. So it's not just a person doing an impersonation, but we have two wonderful actresses, two actors on stage, and they divide up that music. And in between, they will then include just some little tidbits here and there that might include his marriages or some of his career highlights and moments. So you do get a bit of a biography that's sewn in there as well.
So women are also featured as, so it's not people playing Frank Sinatra.
That's right. You have these wonderful tuxedoed men and the women in the gorgeous gowns. And those are some of the nice elements, because the women and their voices then lend a whole different element to some of these songs performed in a way that sometimes you might think, wow, I think this was actually a little better than maybe what old Blue Eyes might have done.
And it sounds like it's very elegant, too.
It is. Again, we want to transform that stage, so we take people to another place. In this case, Ann Davis, our production manager, worked with Greg, the set designer, and recreated Ciro's nightclub. And I know you and I are retro souls, so if you remember the days of old classic Hollywood, New York, and the nightclubs that reigned in the 30s and 40s, Ciro's was it. So a grand staircase, art deco, topiaries, chandeliers to complete the entire evening.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. I loved that Cafe Society, they called
it. That's it. You would expect to see Elsa Mel. Well, or Cole Porter sitting in one of those little cafe tables.
Yeah, and the Stork Club, and what were some of the other ones that were so... the Colony.
The Colony. And then some of those nightclubs were things like the Macambo out in Hollywood that people would also have to be dressed to the nines before you'd go. Right. And that's where this takes you.
Yeah, that's nice. Well, that world doesn't exist so much anymore.
It does not.
At all. Copacabana. That's
Copacabana,
another one.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good
Thinking
one.
Of Carmen Miranda, exactly.
And I love that Barry Manilow song about it, too. So what else do you have coming up at the Theater of the Center?
Well, in addition to those five main stage shows, which the Big Spring musical will be Cabaret, another it's a Broadway classic. We always do our special events programming, which allows people a chance to come in just for a one-night event. So for St. Patrick's Day, Switchback, that Irish concert with our favorite duo, will be back on Sunday, March the 12th, and it's paired up with a wonderful corned beef and cabbage dinner, so we can complete that theme. And then Purdue Varsity Glee Club is always a favorite, and it always sells out. It's only just one performance this year, March 26th, and then I'd be remiss if I didn't mention yours truly, Phil Potempa, and the From the Farm Stage Cooking Show, April the 2nd. So a seven-course meal whipped up in 2 hours with prizes and surprises and a folksy glimpse of the stage recreated like our family farm kitchen.
And this is in the theater? In the theater.
Yes.
So this is you up there doing a cooking show.
That's exactly right. I've done it before at the Star Plaza and some other venues, but it's been a while. So it's back, it's resurrected, and it's a lot of work, but folks love to get a glimpse of that family farm and what happens in the kitchen.
And you really do live on this family farm.
That's right. Yes, just about 30 minutes south of Valparaiso in tiny little San Pierre, Indiana in Stark County.
That's fantastic. I think that's wonderful when people bring their own homegrown talents to their work, and especially in a kind of a public venue like the
that's
Arts
exactly
Center is.
Right.
And oh, that's great. It sounds like, I love cabaret. You know, when the Arts Center first opened in 1989, I had been involved in a community theater production of Cabaret from Crown Point.
Oh.
And we did it in Crown Point first, but then we were invited to do it at the Arts Center.
Oh, that's
I think
fantastic.
That was in spring of 90.
So, that's right about when the building was just launching.
Yeah,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, it was early on. I was the MC.
I knew your role. I knew. Or you could have been the American writer. I could see you lost and finding yourself in Germany and in Berlin.
Know, but he's such a heartthrob in the musical.
You could have pulled it off. I think so.
I don't think so. Well, thank you for saying that. Well, Thanks, Phil, for telling us about My Way. That sounds like a great show. I'm sure it's going to be hugely popular.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
This is John Kane talking with Phil Potampa about the theater at the center's My Way coming up. And you can tune in next Monday for another Eye on the Arts conversation right here on Regionally Speaking. Join us tomorrow night at 8 o'clock for special live coverage from NPR of President Donald Trump's address to a joint session of Congress, followed by in-depth analysis and reaction to the address, including the Democratic Party's response from ex-Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear. You can hear it here on Lakeshore Public Radio tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, and it'll be streaming live online as well at our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.